Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for February 18th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, using DNA tests to catch criminals, how one species of fish resists toxic pollutants, and the winners of the 2010 Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about life on outcast planets, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It's been 10 years since the completion of the Human Genome Project, but a decade is not nearly enough time to measure the impact of a scientific revolution.
Sheila Jasanoff studies the role of science and technology in modern democracies at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and she reflects in this week's issue on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
We should not presume to judge how human lives will change as a result of the publication of the human genome sequence. It's clear, though, that simply weighing past predictions against present realities misses the mark. For example, it's too soon to tell whether cures for genetic disease were oversold or fears of producing a genetic underclass were overblown. What matters is that we found a powerful new way to represent human identity, and the moral implications of that re-representation are just beginning to unfold. The human genome turned out to be a sparse document containing fewer genes than expected. In that way, it is like the Constitution of the United States, which is also a very short text. As with the Constitution, the genome's meanings will evolve over time as scientists, lawmakers, and publics make sense of the fixed elements of the sequence in relation to the variables and unknowns in the surrounding environment. And some outlines of new thinking are already emerging in law and ethics, as well as in biomedicine. Questions have been raised about who can patent genes, how to regulate unconsented uses of genetic information, when to allow familial searching of data banks, who owns immortal cell lines, and what constitutes impermissible mixing of human and non-human genetic material. All these questions point to deeper uncertainty about the moral status of the human genome. And these questions are contentious, but in challenging our taken-for-granted assumptions, they force us to rethink the nature and consequences of being human. In retrospect, this point leaps out as most significant. 2001 marked the issuance of a founding document, a biological living constitution that remakes how we, as individuals and species, interpret our obligations to each other and to other entities on the earth. I'm Sheila Jasanoff.
Sheila Jasanoff studies the role of science and technology in modern democracies at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. In this week's Science and throughout the month of February, you can read vignettes by scientists, artists, politicians, and others reflecting on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
I decided to take a look at the new emerging field of forensic DNA phenotyping, which basically means you're trying to predict what someone looks like based on their DNA.
Science's Martin Ensering reports in this week's issue on the work of forensic geneticist Manfred Kaiser and whether DNA found at a crime scene can predict what a suspect looks like.
We all know traditional DNA fingerprinting, which means you're trying to match a DNA profile of a crime suspect to the DNA that was found, for instance, in a blood stain or a hair or something left at a crime scene. But quite often when you find DNA at a crime scene, it doesn't match any of the profiles stored in police computers. So you're basically left empty-handed. And now scientists are saying, wait a minute, from that DNA at the crime scene, we can still glean information that might help us catch the criminal, the killer, or whatever. Because using that DNA, we can predict what a person looks like. If he had red or blonde hair or dark hair, maybe what his skin color was or what part of the world their family were from, were they Asian, African, European, etc. And for this story, I visited Manfred Kaiser. He's a German geneticist working at Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And colleagues describe him as one of the emerging stars of this field. So I spent the day at Kaiser's lab to see what they're doing and to get up to speed with this new field. And in case you're wondering, Kaiser's lab looks very ordinary. It's a molecular biology lab like you can find anywhere in the world. And it has nothing to do with CSI and all those forensic science shows that you see on TV.
What prompted Kaiser to do this kind of work in the first place?
Well, Kaiser is a geneticist. He's from Germany, and he's very interested in very basic research questions about human genetic variation. But when he did some of his early work, he did on the Y chromosome. It was a genetic study, evolutionary genetic study, but he was interested in the applications as well, if you will. He was interested in how it could help contribute to identifying people. That got him started in this field, and he moved out of it later and then came back when he got this position in Rotterdam in 2004. But he's a basic scientist. Colleagues describe him as very creative, solving very basic questions in genetics. But he finds it fun that it has a practical application as well.
So all this research and the potential for practical applications, that's all being funded by the University of Rotterdam?
It is funded by the University of Rotterdam, but actually the Netherlands Forensics Institute, which is a government crime lab, basically government forensic lab, they gave him a lot of money as well because they realized that this kind of work is best done in academic setting. They're always loaded with casework themselves, and they decided, let's put some of our money in basic research and development at a university, and that's what pays for part of his bills.
You said it was a standard lab. Is it a matter then of using standard genetic techniques or inventing new ones to use DNA to predict how people look?
Actually, a lot of it is standard genetics. What they're doing is they're looking for the genes that are correlated to certain traits. For instance, if you look at eye color, they found a series of about 6 genes. And if you look at those, if you look at markers in those genes, you can predict fairly well what somebody's eye color will be. That's not all that different than looking for instance, disease genes, where they're also doing so-called genome-wide association scans. You're trying to correlate somebody's risk of developing a certain disease with certain markers in the genome. Of course, then what you do with that is very different. They develop tests in this lab that have to have a very high degree of accuracy. They really need to be validated because they're going to be used in criminal investigations. So the application is a little different, but the basic science isn't all that different.
You mentioned eye color as one distinguishing characteristic that they're already, sounds like, pretty far along with. What other things are they looking at in terms of characteristics of people that they could potentially identify with DNA?
Well, all of this is looking for so-called visible traits. They're looking for things that you can also see had you been at the crime scene, if you were an eyewitness at the scene. So they're looking at eye color, which they have a test for now. They're pretty far along with hair color. They identified some key genes in hair color, and they're working on a test right now. Other things that they're looking at is skin color, and they have pretty good hopes of solving that too, at least to some degree. Beyond that, it does get complicated. I mean, if you look at, for instance, something like height, which is one of the things that the police will always want to know, was the criminal tall or short? And we know that that's to a large degree genetic, because tall people get tall children. But finding the genes is very difficult, finding all the genes. There was a study last year published in Nature in which they looked at the genes for height, and they found about 180 loci in the genome, 180 potential markers. But together, they explain about 10% of the difference in height between people. So there's a huge amount of variability that they don't have genes for yet, and they may never find it. And with disease genes in common diseases like, for instance, diabetes, it's been very difficult to find all the genes that predispose you to a higher risk of that disease. And the same may be true for things like height. It may be very hard to elucidate that completely. And there's some things like handedness, whether you're left or right-handed, that may be predictable. The way your earlobe is attached to your head may be predictable. But the holy grail, if you'll forgive me that cliche, but the holy grail of this field is really probably predicting what somebody's face looks like. I mean, ideally, you would do a DNA analysis and a computer would just print out a sketch, police sketch of somebody's face. And again, we know that facial morphology, the form of your face, is highly genetically controlled, because if you look at identical twins which have the same genome, they usually look very much alike even at older ages, even if they live a very, very different life. So we know that the genes are very important. But again, they don't really know how complicated it is and whether they can find all those genes. And so whether that drawing is just a pipe dream or whether it will ever be realized, that's an interesting question that we'll find out, I guess, in the next 2 decades.
You mentioned the characteristics that police are interested in, and height is one of them. That sounds like it will be very difficult. But is there a test for age now? These other characteristics would be affected by age.
Yes, actually, last year, Kaiser and his group published a paper that showed that you can predict somebody's age from a blood sample, although not very precisely. What they did was they looked at the amount of a certain kind of leftover DNA in T cells, tiny snippets of circular DNA that are basically a waste product stored in T cells, and that decreases as we age. Using that measure, they got a very rough indication of somebody's age with at least a margin of error of at least 9 years. So they're not quite there yet, but it may be possible to further refine that as well and to get closer to a more accurate age prediction test.
What, if any, ethical concerns come up with this kind of genetic profiling, for lack of a better word?
Quite a few, although the people I talk to say they aren't major obstacles. But there are things that need to be debated. One of the things is, if you have somebody's DNA, you can also look for their predisposition to genetic risks, to medical risks. And those could be interesting potentially to the police as well, you know, to know that maybe somebody is a hemophiliac or has diabetes. That would be interesting if you knew that when you did your investigation. But that's, of course, very sensitive because that's private information, that's medical information, that's information that you don't want insurers to know. Knowing that a criminal had a certain disease would also inform their relatives that they might be at risk of that same disease. So there's all kinds of issues there. And in fact, Holland, the country where Kaiser does his work, is the only country that has a law regulating this type of DNA phenotyping. And that law explicitly bans any search for medically relevant genes. So you can only look for things that have to do with visible characteristics.
You mentioned earlier the difficulty in diagnosing or understanding the disease genes. As I understand it, even doctors right now have a hard time interpreting genetic results of the tests that researchers do feel are pretty well understood and the associated probabilities for their patients. So I assume then it will be after there are established ways for doctors to interpret genetic results that police investigators will be interpreting genetic results in order to profile potential criminals.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that's another obstacle that this field is facing. It's going to be hard for police officers to understand what the probabilities that this kind of predictions come with actually mean and to interpret them correctly. And some people are worried that this might lead to problems, especially when you're talking about things like skin color or geographical ancestry, which is commonly called race. You know, anytime when there's talk about race and crime, especially in the US, you've got a very explosive mix. So Kaiser and other people I talk to say that, you know, education will be key to explain to people exactly what these tests mean, what they don't mean. One scientist told me, you know, if we move too fast, the whole public confidence in DNA forensic science could erode. So they realized they had to proceed with caution.
Martin Ensering, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Scientist Martin Ensering reports in this week's issue on the work of forensic geneticist Manfred Kaiser and whether DNA found at a crime scene can predict what a suspect looks like.
This species of fish on the Hudson River is dramatically resistant to toxicities from PCBs, which are polychlorinated biphenyls, and dioxins. And what we found was the mechanistic basis, the reason why they're so resistant.
Ike Wergen is lead author of a paper published online by Science on the rapid mutations that allow one species of fish to resist toxic pollution. I spoke with Wergen from his office at the New York University School of Medicine.
And it just comes down to a single gene and a single point on that gene, which is responsible for this resistance.
Before we get to the resistance, how does this species of fish respond to these toxic chemicals, these PCBs? What happens in the body that leads to illness or death for one that isn't resistant?
Well, what happens is in fishes, and probably other organisms too, there's a receptor called the aerohydrocarbon receptor, such that when these chemicals enter the body, they diffuse into the cytoplasm where they bind this receptor. When that occurs, the receptor sloughs off some other molecular chaperones that it has, and it migrates to the nucleus, where it then binds to the upstream regions that control expression of several different genes, and it induces expression of those genes. Now, it's not clear exactly how toxicities occur from these types of chemicals, but we do know that if you knock out this receptor and you expose organisms to these types of chemicals, you don't get these toxicities.
So it could be essentially that it's the reaction to this toxic chemical that leads to death?
Well, there are many downstream events that occur. And what we do know also, say, you know, I work with fish. In fishes, we do know also that when the receptor activates genes, what you also see in many cases, say for PCBs and dioxins, what you see is a whole different suite of toxicities. You get, in fish, you get pericardial and yolk sac edema. You get all kind of craniofacial malformations. The fish, this is during young life stages, they get crowns on their heads. They're missing the jaws. They get curved spines. So you get this whole suite of alterations, developmental alterations, and it's believed, it's been demonstrated, that it all goes back to the heart, that there are structural alterations that are caused in the heart, which makes the heart smaller and less cardiac cells are present, and the heart beats in an abnormal way. So that plays a major role in terms of many of these toxicities, and that's how it occurs to some degree.
Let's go ahead and name which species of fish this study is about, the tomcod.
It's an Atlantic tomcod. It's an interesting little fish. It looks like an Atlantic cod, but unlike Atlantic cod, it doesn't regularly go out into the ocean. It really stays within an estuary, such as the Hudson River. And it's kind of cool with them because they are the only wintertime spawning fish in the Hudson River estuary or any northeastern estuary. In the summertime, they're young of the year. The fish they produced the previous winter are maybe half an inch long, which makes them perfect prey for other species in the river. So they occupy a unique ecological niche within the ecosystem. There's no commercial fishery for them, except in some places in Quebec. They have a tomcod festival and some local tributaries of the St. Lawrence. It's very abundant. You know, some years it's extremely abundant, but there's been a general downward trend in terms of the abundance of tomcod probably for the last 30 years. There's 30 or 40 years worth of data in terms of the abundance of adults and all the younger life stages in the Hudson River.
Does this mutation that you and your team identified in the Hudson River tomcod occur naturally in other populations of tomcod?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, you know, so we surveyed 7 or 8 different populations, and this mutation, this deletion, which was responsible for this resistance, we did find it in the 2 populations that are closest to the Hudson River that still exist. A lot of these populations have been extirpated in the recent past. Global warming, I don't know why. It's a cold water fish. But in these other 2 populations, each of which is about 70, 80 miles from the mouth of the Hudson, the frequency of the deletion variant is 5% or less. So the common allele, you know, without the deletion is in over a 95% frequency. And the only ones that have the deletion in these 2 closest populations have it as a heterozygote. And then you go further away from the Hudson and you don't see the deletion mutant at all. So, you know, that's telling me it probably was in the Hudson before any of these contaminants were present. And also, if you look in the Hudson today, you see the common allele also, but that's also in a very low frequency and maybe 5%, and you also see that only in heterozygotes too.
So the PCBs and other contaminants in the Hudson River essentially gave these fish that already had the mutation a selective advantage.
Yeah, and it's got to be real fast. You think about, you know, if it wasn't, I can't say definitely it was PCBs, but, you know, it's parsimonious with that idea. But PCBs started to be released in the Hudson in 1947, I guess other contaminants at the turn of the 20th century or so, maybe a little bit earlier. So you're talking about really rapid evolution compared to the way most people think evolution occurs. So that's telling me that there really had to be extraordinarily strong selective pressure for this variant allele to achieve these frequencies so quickly.
Has this kind of resistance to PCBs been observed in other species?
Yep.
Beyond just fish?
Oh, resistance to PCBs?
You mentioned the fish serves as food supply for other species.
Well, you know, I didn't go looking for resistance. I didn't say, you know, start some research and say, well, I want to find somebody who's resistant. we were doing studies with Tom Codd, and we were doing some gene expression stuff, and it turned out there's one gene that everybody looks at in fish in response to PCBs. It's called cytochrome P451A. And it turned out that if I caught Tom Codd from Clean Rivers, the gene was highly inducible. If I caught it from the Hudson, I had to use 100 times more PCB to get any response. So that's how we found it. So we haven't looked in any other species. There is another species of fish that's highly resistant to PCBs and dioxins and PAHs from contaminated East Coast estuaries, and that's Atlantic killifish, mummy chugs, they're also called. But it's not the exact same. Nobody knows really why they're resistant. So my guess is there's probably more than one mechanism to resistance among fishes and certainly among vertebrates. Now, you asked me before if other vertebrate population. I can't think of anything else that shows resistance to PCBs except these two fishes. I may be missing something, but probably not.
Okay. What about any cost to the Hudson River tomcod itself? A change in the species fitness because of this mutation?
Well, I haven't empirically evaluated that, but there has to be a community effect in terms of the fish community and other things.
Which means what exactly?
Which means because these fish are resistant, and therefore they are able to bioaccumulate much higher levels of these persistent chemicals such as PCBs than if they were not resistant. If they weren't resistant, they would die, maybe not acutely, but there'd be developmental alterations which would be incompatible with life. So clearly they're able to bioaccumulate much higher levels than if they were not resistant. And as I told you before, it's a really unique fish because of its wintertime spawning, so that a lot of fishes in the summer months in deeper water eat young of the year tomcod. So certainly there is trophic transfer of PCBs and maybe other things up the food chain because of this resistance. Now you asked me at the population level. Evolutionary theory says that if you're resistant to something, then you're less good in terms of life history characteristics such as fecundity, lifespan, a lot of things, or you're more susceptible to other stressors. Now, we haven't looked at that in tomcod, but people have looked at that in other fishes, and in some cases that's been confirmed, in other cases not. You know, you never know. You may not be looking at the right thing, too.
Ike Wergen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Ike Wergen of the New York University School of Medicine is lead author of a paper on the mechanistic basis of resistance to PCBs in Atlantic tomcod from the Hudson River. Find it online at scienceexpress.org. Scientists and artists have struggled for centuries to represent the world around us. And when words fail, there are illustrations, pictures, and videos. To celebrate and encourage those representations, Science Magazine and the National Science Foundation hold a competition each year, highlighting those scientists and artists who find creative ways to explain science visually. In this week's Science and on our website, you can see the winners of the 2010 International Science and Engineering Visualization Contest. Science's Krista Minogue spoke with one of the winners and a judge from the contest and filed this report.
Most entries focus on one tiny aspect of science, like a fragment of DNA or a dangerous bacterium. But one of this year's winners did just the opposite. Candace Elliott tried to explain an entire kingdom in her colorful, comprehensive poster called Introduction to Fungi.
What the poster says visually is, look here, they're beautiful. They're all different shapes. They're all different sizes. They do all different kind of things for us. They create the film of life on Earth. They create some of our favorite foods. They destroy some of our favorite foods. Some of them are very dangerous. Some of them are very good for us. Mushroom is a high-protein food source, low calorie, no fat.
Elliot has been making posters for the University of Wisconsin's botany department for years. But fungi were a completely different challenge, she says, because they're much harder to pin down than plants.
Everything we thought about fungi is just being blown out the window. They're not plants. They're not animals. Some of them we thought were related are not related. Some of them we thought were in a group are now finding out they're in 10, 15, 20 different groups. And each group has its own taxonomic verbiage, which is another pain in the butt trying to study fungi, especially for kids, you know, trying to get interested in them, and they're hit with these books just full of terminology and say, oh, this is so dull and boring. So I wanted people to look at the part of fungi that are not dull and boring, that are beautiful and out there and all over the place, and go just take a look at them.
And looking at Elliot's poster amazed the judges. Elisa Zapmahalik was one of them.
And I think what attracted people to it is that it was colorful, it was understandable, and it was something that we could all relate to. There's all different kinds of fungi. They had pictures of wine and bread and cheese, things that are everyday objects that are made out of fungi or use fungi in some way. And it's not something where you get it and are able to absorb the message with just an initial glance. It's something that you can pore over and continue to learn for quite a while. And I think that's what we experienced as judges in the room as we were looking at it.
One fungus picture that gives people pause has wiped out hundreds of thousands of cave bats, and that's just in the United States. Candace Elliott says the fungus behind white nose syndrome was only identified in 2008.
And it gets bats as they're deep in hibernation in caves, which are cold and moist, and this stuff can only grow in those situations, but it grows on the faces of the bats and suffocates them eventually. It's just horrible. Picture somebody coming into your bedroom while you sleep and put a pillow over your head. It's the same thing.
Another little-known fact in Elliot's poster is that some mushrooms aren't individual creatures at all. They're like flowers that bloom above ground, hiding a much larger and older fungus beneath the surface.
I know there's really huge ones that stretch for acres and acres. I think there's one in eastern Oregon in the Mother National Forest, estimated to cover like 2,200 acres, which is almost 2,000 football fields. And it's at least 2,400 years old, but could be 7,000 years old, or maybe date all the way back to the glacier. We don't know. It seems like some of these things appear to be immortal.
One of the many things about fungi that fascinated contest judge Elisa Zapmahalik.
With fungi, you have some that are poisonous, and some that are edible, and some that are super expensive, and some that are common, and some that you can use to make different foodstuffs, some that smell bad, some that go poof when you kick them, some that look like, you know, little thumbs dripping with green syrup, some that look like cow dung, some that look like orange seashells. See, that's another great thing about this poster is you can look at it for moments, for many moments at a time, and continue to learn new things. It's just chock full of information.
Information that Elliot, an artist, not a scientist, researched.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about this contest.
Again, contest judge Elisa Zapmahalik.
It's the perfect marriage between art and science. And sometimes we know from the write-ups or from the entries themselves whether it's been submitted by a scientist or an artist. But I think the goal, at least one of the goals of the competition, is to make that transparent, to cross the line between science and art, at least to smudge it, such that science can be beautiful and art can be informative.
For the Science Magazine podcast, I'm Kristen Minogue.
Science's Kristen Minogue on the International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge. You can see Elliot's winning fungi poster and find all the winners of the 2010 competition in this week's Science and online at sciencemag.org/special/VIS 2010. Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about life on outcast planets. Dave, what makes a planet an outcast planet?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. It's not that this planet has done anything to annoy its friends. It's that this planet was actually slingshotted out of its planetary system, likely by gravitational interactions with other large worlds. And these planets are destined to wander the lonely cosmos as they slowly freeze.
And life on these planets without any light?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like a very habitable place to be. You're on this planet in the middle of cold, dark space, and everything's frozen. But what scientists propose in this new paper is that actually this could be an environment where life could flourish. And the reason they say that is because imagine one of these outcast planets, but imagine this planet has an ocean, maybe an ocean much like Earth's. Well, that ocean's obviously going to freeze as this planet gets away from its sun. But what the researchers say in this paper is that they've done some modeling, and their modeling suggests that these planets, if they're large enough, can actually have a lot of geothermal activity going on. And this frozen ocean could actually help matters because you've got this heating from below, you've got this insulation from above with this very thick layer of ice, and in between you could actually have a relatively warm and liquid ocean where life could potentially thrive.
So not photosynthetic activity, but chemosynthetic activity. They're living off the elements coming out of the planet's magma or something like that.
Well, right. There's actually organisms like that on Earth, too, that actually live not via photosynthesis, but actually survive off chemicals in the deep, dark oceans. And that's obviously a possibility here. You know, this is all very speculative at this point. What's exciting about this study is that, you know, usually when we're looking for extraterrestrial life, we're looking at these solar systems that can be millions of light years away. What's exciting about this possibility of a rogue planet is that some of these rogue planets could theoretically be closer than a lot of these star systems that we're looking at. And actually, as an aside, that's an intriguing possibility for how life may have started on Earth. Some scientists have theorized that a rogue planet may have crashed into our solar system billions of years ago, possibly seeding it with early life.
But without a star illuminating this planet, how would we ever see it or detect it?
Well, it's a good question, Robin. The astronomers say we could potentially pick these planets up. It would have to be really close by looking for their infrared emissions. And that's possible with some of the telescopes we have today, although it's not very probable. The scientists say that there's only about a 1 in a billion chance that we're going to find one of these worlds with the current technology. But it does still raise the intriguing possibility that the first world besides Earth that we find with life may not actually be one orbiting a star, but maybe one just sort of wandering out there by itself in space.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from outer space to inner space, this next story is about what's actually going on in our nose when we smell odors.
What's actually going on? Some new hypothesis then.
Exactly. Well, the standard hypothesis for how we smell odors is that every odor molecule has a specific shape, and we have these receptors in our nose that detect these molecules. And the idea has been what scientists call a lock and key hypothesis. And basically what that means is that a specific shape molecule fits into a specific shape receptor. And once that happens, we smell a smell like fresh flowers or burnt coffee. But there's a couple problems with this hypothesis. The first problem is we can detect tens of thousands of different odors, yet we only have a few hundred receptors for these odors in our nose. So the math doesn't really seem to work out. The second problem is that a lot of odor molecules are very similarly shaped, almost identical to each other. For example, the odor molecule that gives us the smell of vodka is virtually identical to the one that gives us a smell of rotten eggs. And you would expect if the shapes are so similar that they would activate the same receptor and give us the same smell. So there's some unanswered questions here. And that's where this new study comes in. These researchers in this new study are proposing that the way we smell really doesn't have much to do with a lock and key as much as it has to do with vibrations.
So even though the molecule for the smell of vodka is similar to the one for rotten eggs, they vibrate differently.
That's the idea. And physicists already know this. They know that molecules vibrate at specific frequencies. They even know that very similar molecules, even if they're almost identical, they can actually vibrate at very different frequencies. And that would help start to explain what might be going on in our nose, at least address that second problem with the lock and key hypothesis that very similar molecules can cause very different odor sensations. So it's an interesting hypothesis. And the way the researchers went about trying to prove it was they focused on fruit flies or Drosophila. And the reason they chose flies is because when you're testing humans, humans bring a lot of subjective experiences to the table about, oh, this smells like this and this smells like this. Well, flies, as far as we know, tend to be a lot less subjective. What they did was they put these flies in a maze, and there were two different arms of this maze, and the flies could choose to go into one arm or the other. And into each arm, these researchers pumped nearly identical odors. In fact, one of the molecules they used, the atomic structure was exactly the same, except that instead of a few of the hydrogens, there were deuteriums, which were basically exactly the same as hydrogen. They're just a little bit heavier. So you're talking about nearly identical molecules. And what they found was, even though these molecules were nearly identical, same shape, same structure, same almost everything, the flies displayed a strong preference for one odor over the other. They spent a lot more time in the part of the maze that one odor was pumped in over the other. And that suggests to the researchers that this vibration hypothesis has some validity, because how else could the flies be telling the difference between these two odors?
So what will really clinch it? What other evidence do they need?
Well, as you can imagine, this is a very controversial idea. In fact, it flies in the face of over 100 years of physiological research. So not everybody's very quick to embrace this. And the experts that are quoted in this article say that, you know, they'd like to see much more detailed studies done. They say it's an intriguing idea, but dramatic claims require dramatic evidence, and they don't feel like this evidence is dramatic enough to rule out the lock and key or even to support this vibration theory. But one cool thing about it is, if this is really true, or even if it's at least partially true, it could really help scientists who are trying to develop these artificial noses to sense things like food quality and even sniff out explosives. And the better we know how our own nose works, the better we can design these artificial noses.
Okay, so last one. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, from the tiny molecules that give us our sense of smell to the tiny bacteria that cause human disease, this last story is about a bacterium called Staphylococcus aureus. And this is one of the most deadly killers of humans. In fact, it kills more people in the U.S. every year than HIV/AIDS does. And part of the problem is that this bug is very resistant to antibiotics. So every time doctors try to treat it with drugs, it evolves resistance and it comes back even stronger than before.
Right. I've read about at least one of them, MRSA, right? The methicillin-resistant.
Right. Methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This is a huge problem in hospitals. It can contaminate equipment, very hard to get rid of. And so scientists obviously are trying to develop new antibiotics, but they also have to develop new strategies for combating these bugs. And this last study is about one of those new strategies. It targets something that the bug needs to do in order to survive. And surprisingly, that thing is recycling.
What's it recycling?
Well, it's recycling RNA. And RNA is basically our cellular blueprints. It's what the cell uses to turn the instructions from DNA into proteins, and the proteins that basically run the cell and run our bodies. And even bacteria use RNA, and they recycle RNA just like we do. And the reason we all recycle RNA, it's just much more efficient. You've got all these blueprints and you've got to create new blueprints. Why not just chop these blueprints up and fashion them into new blueprints rather than having to go back to the drawing board and create new ones? So in this new study, the researchers said, if we can throw a wrench in this recycling process, we can kill these bacteria, because they're going to waste a lot of time making new blueprints, or they actually won't be able to do anything at all because they won't be able to recycle and they won't have the raw material to create new RNA, and then they'll die.
Sounds like this could throw a wrench in any cell's ability, though, to recycle RNA.
Well, that's a good question. And obviously, when you're developing any drug that would do this, that's something you've got to worry about. What the researchers did in this study was they first looked for a target. They did a lot of analysis of the Staphylococcus aureus bug, and they found that this one protein, which is called RNPA, seems to be critical to this recycling apparatus. So then they had their first step, and the second step was trying to find some molecules that would disrupt it, and they did this screen with 30,000 molecules, and they found one which they call RNPA-1000, which seemed to block the oxygen of RNPA, and in fact, this drug killed cells from all the major MRSA strains, and it was also effective in mice. Half of mice that were infected with Staphylococcus aureus recovered when given this drug versus none of the mice that weren't given the drug.
And toxicity to people?
Well, in fact, it was toxic when given in high doses to human cells. So the researchers say RNPA-1000 may not be the miracle drug for people, but something very similar to it might be. And at least this gives them a starting point for combating this very difficult to treat infection.
So another way of addressing the problem, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the Policy Blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about why we go to war and also a gene that's been linked to how long birds migrate. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we're continuing our very extensive budget coverage, the impact of President Obama's 2012 budget request on various science agencies, and also some new insights into the anthrax case from 2001. A new study reveals that the scientific evidence used to finger the culprit behind the attacks may not be as strong as once thought. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site, and also be sure to check out the site for our coverage of the annual AAAS meeting that's happening in Washington, D.C. We're going to be covering a lot of the scientific sessions. We're going to be having live chats with rock stars of science, some of the biggest scientific celebrities at the meeting at noon Eastern time every day, and you'll be able to log in and submit your questions about everything from bat migrations to extrasolar planets to the latest in robotics. And Rob, I understand you'll be podcasting from the meeting too.
I will indeed, Dave.
So there's a lot going on. Be sure to check all of it out on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, and of course, all the news from the annual AAAS meeting at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the February 18th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.